Hello, captives and captive friends, and welcome to episode 102 of the Global Captive Podcast, supported by the EY Global Captive Network and hosted by me, Richard Kutcher. We have two very different interviews for you over the next half hour or so. In the second half, you'll be hearing from Lauren Crannell, Director and Head of Global Risk and Insurance at American e-cigarette company Juul Labs, who tells me why forming a captive has been such an important enabler for the business in recent years. First, though, I'm going to be joined by Matthew Reddington, partner and head of the tax controversy practice at ZMF. Matthew is appearing on GCP for the first time because he was heavily involved in a recent court win for the captive manager RMC Group and its president and CEO Raymond Ankner against the United States Internal Revenue Service. A jury verdict found in favour of RMC and Ankner in a first major court win for the 831B market, and Matthew explains to us the background for the case and what it might mean for future 831B legal activity and battles going forward. So Matthew, welcome onto the Global Captive Podcast. Really good to have you on and to hear this insight. Just so our listeners know who they're hearing from, can you tell us a bit about you and your background and your role today at ZMF?
Sure, and thank you for having me on. I began my career 10 years ago with the IRS Office of Chief Counsel as a litigator, and I left the IRS about 6 years ago to come to ZMF and now partner and head of our tax controversy practice at ZMF.
Fantastic. So this case then, I've shared a little bit about this case in the introduction, but it'd be great to hear background and detail from yourself. So you are representing RMC Group and its president and CEO, Raymond Ankner, in this case against the Internal Revenue Service. Can you tell us what the case was focused on and how it came about?
The case began as a promoter audit that started more than a decade ago. The IRS asserted penalties under Section 6700 for promoting a tax shelter. Mr. Ankner and each of the RMC entities each paid 15% on at least one of the years and one for each one of the entities. They didn't file the refund for each of those penalties paid, which was promptly denied. And then we were able to file suit in the Middle District of Florida asking for a refund. The government counterclaimed for the remaining years and the amounts, which we had worked out and agreed to beforehand so that all the amounts at issue would be brought in and part of the case. For Section 6700, the government has the burden of proof, which is not typical. Typically, everything they adjust is presumed correct. But here, they must prove that there was a plan or arrangement with a false or fraudulent statement, and the person that made the statement had to know or have reason to know as to a material matter. The DOJ, representing the IRS here, focused on whether RMC's offering of captive insurance was actually insurance. They conceded all the other elements of what makes insurance other than risk distribution. So they argue that any statement that insurance premiums are deductible are false since there wasn't risk distribution within the program and therefore it wasn't insurance. They seem to take the knowledge requirement for granted, and which is where we focused with the jury. Obviously, there was no guidance from the IRS at the time other than Revenue Rule 2002-89, which for risk distribution, risk shifting, and they followed that guidance. And that's where we hammered to the jury. The government has to prove every element of 6700, and they can't prove knowledge or reason no when RMC followed the only IRS guidance provided on meeting that requirement.
Great. So that's really useful the background. I think it's important to note here, and I think you have done, that obviously this is a different kind of case. This is a case regarding a captive manager or a promoter, as they're sometimes labeled, particularly by the IRS, rather than about one specific captive. Could you tell us, I've seen on LinkedIn and some commentary obviously hailing this result as a really good thing for the kind of 831B captive market. Can you talk us through what the result was and can you explain to us what it means in practice for Mr. Ankner and RMC?
Yeah, so the jury was asked whether Mr. Ankner and each of his entities should be held liable for the Section 6700 penalty for each of the tax years. The jury came back that no, they should not be held liable. If they had come back as on yes on any one of them, they would have had to determine the amount, if it was a reduced amount or if the full amount the IRS had assessed. But they came back as no on every single tax year for each of the entities, which obviously big win for us, big loss for the DOJ and for the IRS. You know, the penalties totaled just shy of $4 million with interest, but would have been about $8 million once fully computed, and you know, it would just put RMC out of business. Now, you know, as you mentioned, this is not an individual captive, and it's a jury trial, so it's not precedential for going forward that, you know, we can use and rely on this result. But the pushback to the DOJ and to the IRS is that they've become feeling that they have 10 feet tall and bulletproof on the captive insurance market. They've won, you know, 7 cases in a row in the U.S. tax court. But there's other avenues to get better results. And I think moving forward, as we push on these buttons and try to find ways that we can take this out of the tax court's hands and find ways to put this in front of a jury, that those wins aren't nearly as automatic, which should help for settlement purposes, should help for maybe reconsideration, or maybe even not even taking the case at all from on behalf of the IRS.
So what do you think then this case result means more broadly, Ben, in terms of how the IRS and tax court kind of approaches 8501B captives and their advisors involved in this space?
The IRS has certainly taken the approach and view that 831B captives, any of these, you know, micro captives, so to speak, are all bad and all wrong, are all doing this in a way that is inappropriate and shouldn't be operating in this space. So they've come down as full disallowances on everything, coming after all these managers as promoters and accusing them of promoting tax shelter. This should help in pushing that back. I mean, the IRS, you know, they take a bully approach in a lot of tax matters, where they know that they can outspend and take more time and more resources than the individual taxpayers. But with any bully, you got to punch them in the nose to get them to lay off. So hopefully this is the first of many of a punch in the nose that pushes them back, so that we can get to a better space and more equal footing on these individual micro captives, but also for the promoter exams and the penalties that they're assessing against promoters. Now, it's not precedential. The opinion won't be from the jury is not precedential, but this is their first loss, and putting their loss in front of them certainly helps to help them reprioritize and decide whether it's worth going forward and to take more losses in the area or to adjust and take a different tactic.
Yeah, I mean, what's your general assessment then of kind of some of the previous 8501B captive cases? I think the obvious one that springs to mind is Avrahami, the first one. We've had others such as Syzygy, Reserve Mechanical, etc. I mean, they were kind of early, I think, fairly emphatic wins for the IRS. How much have they influenced that IRS kind of bully boy tactic, that strategy since then? And have those, do you think those early cases have kind of disproportionately impacted how this space has been treated?
Oh, 100%. I mean, the IRS was very deliberate in what cases they brought first in making law in this area. Avrahami in particular was a practiced approach to make sure that some of the worst facts make it into the first opinion. I mean, bad facts make bad law, and that case had a lot of bad facts. And the tax court has shown that maybe it doesn't understand exactly the captive insurance markets and the industry, especially the small captive insurance companies. They don't have a full understanding of those companies and the way that the markets work, but it certainly doesn't help when the case law or the facts in front of us are proportionally bad. So, you know, those early cases, they were a deliberate approach by the IRS to make sure that they won in this area. And it is continued, it's had a snowball effect of creating more and more no's from the court, even as the facts start to get better. Now, that will not last forever. The cases that are moving into trials and that will now be opinions issued by the court, the facts are getting much better and meeting the requirements for risk distribution, risk shifting, insurance in the commonly accepted sense in ways that the first cases really could not. That will eventually change, and as long as people keep fighting and putting forth the effort. Now, the IRS has shifted some of their focus into other areas and moved to more onto conservation easements, and there'll be a huge focus on ERCs in different areas, which will take their resources away from this. And then as long as we continue to fight and push with better facts, we should see some changes in the law.
And just lastly then, Matthew, we know there is a significant backlog of 831B cases that need to or could make it into court. And I think they're a combination of both individual captive cases and also kind of captive manager promoter cases. You know, we've seen data that suggests almost 1,000 cases are kind of still pending hearing. What's the likelihood of the judicial system kind of working through all or a significant portion of those cases?
Courts will eventually pull through each of these cases, but unless the taxpayer is pushing diligently on moving these forward, they're going to end up settling out, being forced to settle or to concede just because of the legal fees, or just need to have a resolution so the company can be sold or someone can retire. So if we don't push these forward, the court will let them languish to the detriment of the taxpayer for years and years. But you know, as long as the attorneys, the taxpayer and their attorneys are pushing these forward in ways that will keep them moving, getting them calendared, getting them docketed, pushing for hearings, the court will eventually get to all of them, but it's going to take many, many years. So you have to be very proactive in pushing these forward to get the results that we want to see and be able to move these forward. Otherwise, it's going to take, a considerable amount of time, and the court's quite protective of its docket. So, you know, any chance it can to delay or to move these forward, knowing that the delays only, you know, put a resolution more likely than a trial into their books, all the better. So concessions and settlements are good for the court, but not necessarily good for the taxpayer making good law. You'll have to certainly push forward on each of these to be able to get them ever to get a full resolution.
Well, Matthew, it's been really good to have you onto the Global Captive Podcast. We appreciate you sharing kind of your experience and your insight into this case.
No, happily. Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, thank you to Matthew for providing that context and insights, and we will be keeping a close eye on future 831B tax court cases and those involving captive managers in their ongoing battle with the IRS. Now, let's hear from a captive owner in a very different business. Juul Labs is an electronic cigarette company, which, of course, brings all kinds of risks and challenges when dealing with the commercial insurance market. Juul Labs formed a Hawaii captive in 2020, and the company's director and head of global risk and insurance, Lauren Cranell, was happy to come onto the pod and talk a bit about his previous experiences with captives and why it has been such an important development for Juul Labs. He starts by telling me about his background in treasury and how he found himself in risk and insurance.
You know, I've been very lucky to have many roles in finance, including accounting, FP&A, and most of my time was in treasury, investment management being the highest percentage of my roles. You know, I was truly lucky to start my career in a startup where everyone was responsible for large amounts of value. And, you know, I got to build a treasury and risk function and understand cross-functional partnerships during my first professional job. And that's really been a catalyst for how I approach, any project throughout my career. And I just thank my lucky stars for having that first job. And about 15 years ago, I started becoming more oriented in risk management. It is just, treasury teams have been relatively lean, low headcount, putting on multiple hats. And I really started getting back into risk management. And I started to partner with legal teams and others during negotiations, and I really began to enjoy it. And in particular, with the legal teams, I really embraced the similarities of our department's objectives. You know, legal, first and foremost, they mitigate risk in so many ways to contract management. And then I start building my risk management function kind of along those lines of how can I mitigate risk through thought leadership and partnering with other parts of the business leaders. And then at the end of the day, when I had the opportunity to kind of jump into risk management, I really appreciate the operational aspects of it. And I really enjoy this role. I feel energized every day. And now I no longer am a part of traditional treasury, and I'm solely in risk management. So I've been very blessed in my career.
So great. So obviously a lot of finance background, which I think is particularly obviously useful when working with captives. So I think you've had a few experience with captives. Just talk a bit about that experience.
So in terms of, you know, building my two captives from the ground up, the first one was customer facing, which requires state compliance. For instance, you know, Washington State is very particular. And the latest was to provide only to insure first party risk, which allowed me to kind of build this captive. The latest captive is solely built up around supporting the company and its objectives from a business perspective, a compliance perspective. And then the hardest part of the experience was really truly to identify the usefulness of the captive and to advocate for it. So that experience, when I come away from the two captives I built up, is that experience of getting them approved has been the most valuable for me as a professional, and how I share those experiences with others.
Yeah, I think we'll talk a bit about that in more detail later in terms of kind of your lessons learned and advice to people in forming captives and getting them set up. Let's talk a bit about Jewel Labs then. Tell us a bit about your role at Jewel Labs.
At my prior company, we had a relationship with Deloitte, and Jewel Labs was looking for its first risk manager. And they were doing a project with them. And they said, you know, take a look at Lauren. So I was the very first risk manager at Jewel Labs. And the very first thing when I walked in the door, it was the lack of marketing in the past. So my first initiative was immediately build partnerships with the insurers. They needed to understand the company, to understand the mission, and understand the executives who were running it. So that was my first role. It was to buy insurance, make sure we're compliant with our requirements, keep our cost of insurance manageable, at the same time, building those relationships. And one of the things I would tell people about my role at Jewel Labs was the house was on fire and I was rebuilding the house at the same time. And so being the first dedicated risk manager, it was my sole focus was the risk management needs of the company, understanding the changing market environments, leveraging my, you know, previous relationships with insurers through many different companies in the past. And then once kind of the 2019, when I was first there, kind of getting through the first renewal, then my role was to start working with the many business leaders within the company, understanding the risk, working with them to mitigate the risk, and then listening and caring about their concerns, you know, ongoing supply chain risk, geopolitical risk, things that a lot of risk managers don't have the chance or the opportunity to be a part of. Since we're a small company, I was very lucky to have that kind of, you know, partnership. But the first thing I did was I was a listener, I cared, and it wasn't about buying insurance. It was more about understanding the risk. And then lastly, the primary role at Jewel Labs as a former legal person at the company and being part of the finance team is just to do whatever I can to help the company in any way. You know, we've gone through many rounds of reductions. So the team that's there, you know, we're all very motivated. We care about the team. So there's things I do. A lot of times it's not even risk management. It's just being a part of the finance team.
Fantastic. So in terms of the captive then that you have set up at Jewel Labs, tell us kind of how that came about and maybe what was the motivation? Why did you set that captive up?
I think we understand from the very first renewal that there was going to be some resistance in the marketplace. They didn't understand the company. They didn't understand the space. So the very simple reason of why we set it up was to have the control we needed for the business environment. Even if we didn't put any risk in the captive, we needed to have the opportunity and the option of putting those a risk into the captive. You know, I think every risk manager out there has looked at the last 3 to 4 years of hard markets and wavering insurance commitments, and we just want to mitigate those by having a captive. We also wanted to look at the way of what is risk. You know, we wanted to build a kind of environment that just insures risk, but understands risk. And the captive has been a good motivator for that. And, you know, one of the things that we do at Jewel is that we're always looking at ways to, you know, minimize operational impacts to the P&L. You know, so there's a lot of different ways that captive, you know, provides optionality for that. And that's why we put it in place.
And when you did put it in place, Lauren, you chose Hawaii as the captive domicile, a very popular domicile in the United States, particularly on the West Coast. So how did you choose Hawaii as your captive domicile?
Yeah, fortunately, I set up the first captive I did at a different company in Hawaii. And a lot of the reasons were the same. West Coast, easy location to get to. Many of the tech companies use Hawaii. For my peers and for myself, we find the domicile to be very fair. It's knowledgeable. They're timely on incorporating, you know, traditional lines or new lines of coverage. You know, and what I tell the board members that, you know, while Hawaii is a great place to visit and everyone thinks it's a boondoggle, but Hawaii doesn't require all board members to be on location. And I think that with executives having busy schedules and many of the board members are, you know, also directors or officers of the parent, that time is, you know, pretty crucial. And I think that by Hawaii allowing some flexibility of being on telecommunications for the boards was super helpful for the executive team. And I think the last point is expense. Hawaii is a lower cost domicile, has excellent on-island providers for legal and external audit. So it's just been a very good way to set up a captive. Even if I had more time, I probably would have gone back to Hawaii anyways.
Yeah, that familiarity is definitely crucial. We hear that quite often with risk managers that have had captives and set up captives in multiple companies. They often gravitate, as long as it makes sense, you know, for that particular situation, they often do gravitate back to kind of what they're familiar with and the people they've worked with before. So yeah, certainly familiar. I'm interested to know, obviously, you utilize the commercial market as well, Lauren. So how has having the captive kind of impacted the partnerships and relationships that you have with the commercial market?
I think it has helped. And I think that even if you don't even place a certain risk into the captive, having the ability or option to put something into the captive, it kind of opens up the conversations and the negotiations around with your underwriters. Because you're going from, hey, I need to buy insurance, to I'm also an underwriter. I know my risk really well. Let's really talk about what's going on here, you know, with the insurance. And I think the one line I would keep in mind is cyber. Looking at cyber, putting that as a captive option, we've had very, very good conversations about, okay, these people know their risk. They're willing to put their own money to insure this risk. And I think the conversations are a little bit more real. A quote to them is, I'm insured, but I'm an underwriter. Let's talk about the pricing for the risk that's really being put into the captive or being insured. And I think it's been a tremendous kind of like level set between my partnerships with the commercial markets.
And how about relationships then with your brokers and how has that evolved with the captive involvement?
It's been good. Every firm will have a broker who's not supportive, and then you have to find the broker within the firm that's going to be supportive. And I have a remarkable team at Marsh. They're my primary broker on the commercial lines for Jewel Labs. they're also my captive operational provider. So I think that takes away the competitive nature. It's not firm versus firm. I try to keep it all in the family. Marsh has done a very good job of kind of supporting the captive. They help me identify, you know, potential solutions. There's been no drama from my broker team in putting risk into the captive, knowing that there's going to be a loss of commission. I'm very grateful for that. You know, what I appreciate the most is that it's evolved, because a lot of brokers really don't understand the captive benefits, because that's not what they're trained for. They're trained to sell insurance. So I think the group I have really spent a good 3 to 4 years of understanding my needs and kind of evolving their own practice to help support that. So I'm very grateful for that. And I think one of the resulting benefits that we created was, we call it the Risk Advisory Group. So it's a partnership with my Marsh broker team and some of the professionals within Marsh and myself. And we created kind of a internal equivalent to Deloitte or KPMG. We really wanted to model, you know, risk, provide guidance, understand risk, and then, you know, we can strive to provide guidance to inform decisions with or without captive involvement. I think what's really important is that the Marsh team has evolved into a broker and has become more of an advisory service to myself and to the company. And then at the end of the day, we create data-driven analysis and quantify our risk. And then those data-driven analysis will help decide decisions on, do we put it in the captive? Do we mitigate? Do we insure it? What do we do with it? And I think the Marsh relationship has been really good for that.
Yeah, really interesting use of your advisors. So, I mean, how much has the captive then been a real business enabler for Jewel Labs? How crucial has it been?
So I would say it's been a tremendous business enabler. So in terms of the captive, giving Jewel Labs the peace and the space and time to operate without having to worry about COIs and risk and insurance has been a massive business enabler. And at the end of the day, we couldn't allow an insurance underwriter to have the possibility to influence our business. The last 3 or 4 years with hard markets, some insurers have been very tough on pricing or on availability of risk. And we took that variable out of our operational model. And I'm very proud of that.
So away from Jewel Labs specifically then, I'm interested, Lauren, obviously you've got experience of building a couple of captives. You seem quite passionate about particularly the risk management side of risk financing. Do you have a general philosophy or approach to kind of risk financing strategy?
I do. At the beginning, my approach is to understanding the risks, data-driven, understanding, you know, how much can we mitigate to minimize what we would need to finance. I'm very operationally minded. And one of the things I used to get really upset about was being told to buy X amount of insurance with no understanding if that was too much, too little. So my first philosophy is understanding how much do we really need. And I think that's the very first step of my process. And then having strong relationships with the legal team, understanding the people in operations and finance to get kind of tops down, bottoms up, side to side of the severity and impact of what a loss would be. And then before having the concept of putting it into the captive is, again, how much, but then also to understand all the variables that can affect a risk. And then by knowing that amount, it makes it a much easier decision to decide how much we want to finance, either through insurance markets, self-insure, or using a captive. And the true result for me is having enough risk transfer and reward to make sure that we can preserve as much capital. Because one of the things I'm trying to do is I'm always trying to build capital. So I would rather cost of borrowing, cost of capital can be quite high. By maintaining, you know, preservation of capital will allow us to use those funds and get a good rate of return from that, from the savings there.
So you've obviously got, we've heard you've got experience, Lauren, of building captives from the ground up. How, you know, I talk to a lot of risk managers who are doing it for the first time or just starting out on the journey. As you know, there's lots of new captive formations at the moment. How were those experiences? And I think importantly, what advice would you have for risk managers who are embarking on that kind of first captive journey?
Yes, I think both experiences were incredibly rewarding. I would say the first time, the first captive took almost 4 years to find the right opportunity. I'll start from the goal, and kind of the philosophy has to be, you have to look at the captive as a standalone business. And I illustrated the value in pro forma financial statements, because the decision maker will usually be a CFO, someone from, you know, a finance executive. And you got to talk the same language. You have to show the captive is creating positive value. No better way to do that than doing pro forma P&Ls. Because at the end of the day, it's a real company. It's a legal entity that rolls up easily into the parent. You're going to have to do consolidated financials at the end of the month, every month. So what's the best way to kind of level set and make those numbers concise? Is put into pro forma. Because I think a lot of times risk managers that talk to me about the captive, they get so wrapped up into the risk that's being put into the captive versus the long-term benefits from a P&L perspective. So what I would recommend when you do your captive, you know, analysis, you're going to have to put it into kind of pro forma statements for your business case that usually show the impact, you know, in 1, 3, and 5 years in low loss and high loss situations. And this area is extremely important to have, to do it right, to have your actuarial, like, be really in tune to the risk. You have to provide them the data that they need to create those models. If the captive is profitable in a low risk situation, it'd be a lot easier to support that initial capital. And then when I look at the same modeling, look at the same time frame with no losses and how much cash will build up over time. This can add additional lines of coverage, but it's an important note that the cash being built up is what should have been, you know, paid to third-party insurers. So I always go to the CFO. Do we want to pay, you know, X amount of millions to an insurer that we have no losses on or very low losses, or do we want to put it into the captive? And if you have no losses, that cash builds up pretty quickly. And I think that is a good and a strong selling point. And I think, but you always want to be conservative on your capital requests and loss run forecast. Because unfortunately, if your captive runs into a big loss early on and you have to ask for more capital, I would envision that would be a really difficult conversation to have. But you have to be prepared for those questions too. So when you're going through your approval process and they're saying, well, what if I have a big loss in year two that's going to require more capital? You got to be honest. That's always a possibility. That's why you have to understand the frequency of those risks and make sure you can kind of highlight that true, that is possible, but it's only 1 in 100 chance that risk could and that loss could materialize. So that's really important. And I think always be prepared for the adversarial approver. A lot of people don't know about captives. It's a lot of work. You just got to be prepared for those questions of why can't we just self-insure it? Why do we need a captive? Why do we need to create this legal entity? You know, the answer is very simply, you can't, you know, create certificates of insurance if you're self-insured. If you want to be legally compliant with your contracts, you do need the ability to provide some sort of proof of insurance. And that can only be done through a captive or through a third-party insurer. So you just have to be prepared. I think that's the first and foremost, be conservative, but talk about it in financial terms, and it goes a long way.
Thanks, Lauren. I think that's really useful for people to hear. So just finally then, just to conclude, and I think you've probably covered
most of this, but I just, you know, be interested to hear from you just lastly, why do you view captives as such valuable risk financing tools?
I think for me, just having the optionality, you know, all of us who, you know, gone to be financial, you know, professionals, we're always looking at ways to solve things. A lot of times as a risk professional, you go to banks and you go to advisors. By having a captive, it allows you the flexibility. It allows you to understand the risk. And then in terms of financing, would you rather go to a bank or go to within a captive? And to me, it's just the option. I've never been more like, when I started doing captives about 10 years ago, it's been the most rewarding thing I've done in my career, because I get to be operational, I get to be financial, I get to be help legal. And the captive has just provided so much potential solutions for the company that I'll have a hard time not being part involved with the captive. If I was to move to a different role and I couldn't do a captive, I would be pretty sad.
Okay, well, Lauren, it's been great to have you on the Captive podcast. Always like to hear people with an equal amount of passion for captives as I do. So, Lauren, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you to Lauren Crannell of Jewel Labs for that captive owner insight. And I think there was some particularly great advice at the end there for risk managers who may be starting out on a captive formation journey. Thank you also to Matthew Reddington from ZMF, who joined us at the start of the pod to talk about the recent jury verdict in favour of Raymond Ankner and the RMC Group. That's it for now. So stay safe, stay well, and see you next time, captives.